Feels good to sit down, doesn't it? And all of God's people said? Okay. I kind of know what you're thinking, so it's all right. We are kind of experiencing this morning in our service a microcosm of life itself because of the word change. I don't think you expected quite what you received this morning. And they even indicated, you know, that this was a little different than what is normal. And it was kind of fun, I thought, to observe them and to enter into worship being led by the young people. But it was a little different, wasn't it? A little different. Actually, truth be told, I wasn't even supposed to be here this morning. That's a change, too. Someone else was scheduled to speak to you this morning, and that changed a couple of weeks ago, week and a half or so ago. And so here I am, and you weren't expecting that, and that's okay. That's life, is it not? Life actually changes. And as I speak to you this morning, I actually am experiencing some personal changes myself. The brother mentioned that I am the representative of the churches here in Ohio, regular Baptist churches. I work with 148 churches and have been doing that for over 17 years. But I announced my impending retirement coming in October. And so a search committee has been formed, and they are engaging people. They told me the other day they have 48 names that they're working through, someone to take my job. It's kind of a funny feeling to help people find somebody to take your job. It's a change, I guess, kind of a big-time change for Pat and for me, and we'll just see what the Lord will do. I have learned to say in that regards that I am retiring from this position, but I am not retiring from ministry. And we'll see what the Lord will open up. I understand you don't force ministry doors open. You do go through them, but you don't beat the door down. So we'll just kind of see what the Lord will do with us in the coming months and years. But we're working through this period of change. And some of you, I know, are on the other side of that retirement thing, and you can give me all kinds of good advice, and my ears are very much open to you and to your input. But it's a time of change for me and my good wife. And then the telephone rang on Friday morning of this week, and I got news that my sister, Ruby, up in Dearborn, Michigan, or near there, passed away on Thursday evening, late. And so I was actually supposed to be here tonight. That he alluded to the fact that I often speak to the evening worship service at 6. I was supposed to be here tonight. However, with this change in the family now up in Michigan, I will be leaving this afternoon, driving there and conducting the funeral of my sister tomorrow in the Detroit area. So when I say that this service is kind of a microcosm of life itself and the changes through which we go, I'm really not teasing. There really is truth and relevance in those words to all of our lives. Life changes, doesn't it? Our families change. Work situations change. Our personal health and finances change. And as I have learned over these years, working with the churches change. And so I speak to you this morning about reality and about the reality of change in our lives. Now, you know that we have two services here, one at 9 and one at 10:30. After the 9 o'clock service, a young lady came to me and she said, I would like you to at least define the word change. You know, what are you talking about when you talk about change? I thought that was a perceptive question. And the answer that I gave to her is that what I'm talking about are those unexpected shifts in life. It's just a simple little definition. Unexpected shifts that occur in our lives. Before we get too negative about the whole business of change, I think it's important that I remind you that not all changes are bad. Not all changes through which we go are really bad things. For example, I hope you know what I'm talking about. Paul wrote this, "If any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things become new." The word for that is change, is it not? It's the change that occurs in a person's life at the point of salvation, when we come to know Christ as our Savior. And many lives are just turned around completely, 180 degrees, as was Saul, the Apostle Paul. That's a change for the good. And I hope that you have experienced that change, that you know the newness and the freshness and the righteousness that comes into life by virtue of the change. Whether you call it salvation or conversion or being born again, whatever the particular label may be, it is a good change, not a bad thing. In my personal experience, I experienced a change when I got married. Marriage was a good thing for me. We've now been married for 52 years and 4 children and 13 grandchildren. And as I look back over my life, I understand the value, the input of my wife Pat into my life and my thinking and et cetera. And it was a good change. It was the best thing I did to say, I do, those over 52 years ago. That was a change for the good. You understand what I'm saying. Sometimes we kind of get dragged kicking and screaming through some rather negative changes. But we must be careful lest we begin to become so negative and fearful that we think that all change is necessarily bad. We know better. And because we know better, then we have to ask this question. If all change isn't necessarily bad, then why is it that we resist change so much? We do resist it. I resist change. I tend to drag my feet and to question and perhaps even object. And so it's another good question when you start thinking about life and change. Why do we tend to resist? Why do we tend to fear change anyway? And there are probably lots of answers. I'll just suggest one or two. And I'm sure you've thought of this. I think we tend to resist change because change forces us to realize how little control we actually have over life. Change, when it kind of elbows its way in to our life and says, okay, deal with it, deal with me, we say, wait a minute, I don't think I'm in as much control as I thought. Whether it be health or finances or family or church or the workplace or whatever the particular arena in which that change is happening, is kind of like, well, I feel real good about life as long as I've kind of got it in control and my ducks are all in a row and we're moving in the right direction. But all of a sudden, I have to realize, wait a minute, I'm really not in control of very much at all. And it is that realization that is forced upon us by virtue of change. Not only the matter of how little control we actually have of life, but I think on occasion, change also forces us to realize just how quickly life is moving. By the way, it is moving quickly, isn't it? And it is the changes, you know, our children grow and then they graduate from high school or they graduate from college and then they get married and then they have children, etc. And all of those changes, those shifts that I just described. All of those shifts kind of remind us, we look back and say, now wait a minute, I can remember when you were just. And I don't think I'm ready for you too. And we say, boy, time marches on. I can't stop this thing. And It is the changes that come that remind us how little control we actually have and how quickly life is actually moving. And so for those reasons and probably more, we tend to resent and resist change. So I'm talking to you this morning about life. I'm talking to you about reality. And if you walk out the doors and get in your car and head for home and somebody says, hey, what did that preacher talk about today? I hope you will remember at least to say, well, I think he talked about change. At least that was the subject. Well, what did he say about change? So I got to give you the whole title there. What I'm talking to you about this morning is what I call the Christian response to change. The Christian response to change. I don't think we always respond Christianly to change. I don't think I always respond Christianly to change. Some of my more non-Christian responses to change sound like this. Why? Why now? Why me? Why us? Lord, you could have prevented that. Didn't even have to come into our lives, you know. And my favorite, how are you going to bring any good out of this mess? Have you ever said things like that or felt or thought things like that? In case you missed it, those are the non-Christian responses to change. So it is important that we respond Christianly, biblically, accurately to change. I do like what Chuck Swindoll said years ago. Life is 10% what happens and 90% how we respond to what happens. I'd like you to think about that. Life is 10% what happens and 90% how we respond to what happens. And if that is true, or if those numbers are even close to true, then it seems to me a legitimate sermon topic, a legitimate usage of your time and mine to think about, well, what is a Christian response to change? The text of the morning is 1 Samuel chapter 3. 1 Samuel chapter 3. I'm going to read in a moment the entire chapter. You will recognize it as the account, the calling of the little boy Samuel into what I'm going to call the ministry. At the beginning of this chapter, he is simply a little kid in a dark tent. By the time you come to the end of the chapter, Samuel is the acknowledged leader of Israel. Big time change between verse 1 and verse 21. Yeah, you will look futilely for the word change in this text. I know that. But in the bigger picture of the Old Testament, this is the event, this is the scene that became the catalyst for big-time change for a whole lot of people. And so I have chosen this as, again, a little bit of a microcosm, a little bit of a lesson which I'm calling the Christian Response to Change. And so I read 1 Samuel 3. Yeah. Now the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. And it came to pass at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, and when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down, that the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, "Here I am." So he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Eli said, "I did not call, lie down again." And he went and lay down. Then the Lord called yet again, "Samuel." So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." He answered, "I did not call, my son, lie down again." You may wonder why you have this kind of interaction going on. Is it really that important in the story? And I think the reason it's included here is that it does show Samuel's carefulness about taking care of Eli. Eli was a senior citizen. This is just a youngster, really, with him there at the tabernacle in Shiloh. And so he hears this voice calling, and he presumes, well, it's Eli, and he needs me, and so he's up in the middle of the night, etc. It speaks well of Samuel and the carefulness with which he was caring for Eli. I think that's at least part of the reason it's included here. Verse 7, "Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again the third time. So he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you did call me.' Then Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, 'Go, lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" I want you to think about those words. Those are very pivotal words, not only in this story, but for our lives. "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood and called as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel answered, "Speak, for your servant is listening." Then the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." It goes without saying, but I'll say it, that was not good news. That was not something that Samuel wanted to hear, and it certainly was not something that Eli really wanted to know. Or I should say, at least, he didn't want to hear it. Therefore, and you can understand then, in verse 15, "So Samuel lay down until morning, and he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. And Samuel was afraid to tell Eli the vision." Understandably so. "And he said," this is Eli, "'What is the word that the Lord spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. God do so to you and more also if you hide anything from me of all the things that he said to you.' Then Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, now watch his words, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. I want to read that again. It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. So Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, that's like from Cleveland to Portsmouth, top to bottom, north to south, all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel had been established as a prophet of the Lord. Then the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. I've labeled this kind of as a catalyst, this event, this calling of Samuel in the middle of the night and this negative message that he delivered, the Lord delivered to Samuel and then Samuel to Eli. I've called this a catalyst of great change, and I think I need to take a minute to demonstrate that to you. This began a political change in Israel. Samuel, as you may know, if you know the history of the Old Testament, Samuel actually functioned as the last judge. He was the final person in a line of judges who for some 300 years had ruled Israel. And now, because of this calling on this one night and the events that came from it, this final judge introduces the nation to the rule of kings. And it is Samuel who actually anoints the first two kings of Israel, Saul and David. So this man transitions. He changes the governance, the political structure of Israel from judges to kings. And that change started on this night. And because of this night. Again, up to this time in the nation's history, the religious leaders of Israel were the priests. Aaron, his sons, when the people had a question about the law or its interpretation or its application to life, they went to the priest at the tabernacle. But because of this call on the life of Samuel and the change that he instituted, you'll notice the wording there at the end of the chapter, now he is recognized as a prophet. And Samuel establishes, and you'll read of them in the Old Testament, he actually establishes the schools of the prophets. So that now, when people need to know something about the law, its interpretation, its application, they're no longer going to the priests. Now they're going to the prophets. And it all began on this night. So you have a political transition. You have a religious transition. And as you know, you also have the beginning of a military transition. Remember that at this time, 1 Samuel 3, in the period of the end of the period of the judges, the Israelites are under the thumb of the Philistines. The Philistines so subdue Israel that the Israelites do not even have any weapons of their own. And they cannot even work with metal or make their own farm implements. They have to take old and broken farm implements to the Philistines. They will repair them for them because the Philistines are absolutely subjugating Israel and they do not want them to make any kind of weapons. As a matter of fact, the reason the tabernacle is in Shiloh is because Shiloh was the most defensible place in case of an attack by the Philistines. But by the time you come near the end of Samuel's influence and ministry, the Philistines are being defeated, later to be completed by King David, Saul and David themselves. And so you have a change in the nation of Israel, both as to its governance, as to its religious leadership, and as to its military position. And of course, Samuel begins the chapter as just a little kid in a dark tent. But he finishes the chapter as the acknowledged leader of the whole nation. From Dan to Beersheba, everybody knew Samuel was ordained to be a prophet of God. All of that simply to say, I think it's an appropriate text to talk about life, to talk about change, and to learn something about what I'd like to call the Christian response to change. Now I'm going to draw your attention, as you might guess, to those two verses. First verse 18, and then we'll go back to verse 10. And in both cases, they come from Eli. It might be a little surprising, considering the message that was delivered to Eli. But I want you to notice again, verse 18. Then Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him, and Eli said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Now I'm going to put a label on that just to help us kind of think about it, walk out of here with it, talk together about it. I hope that you will. The Christian response to change, especially when negative things come blowing into our lives and threaten to blow us away, the Christian response to change is submission to God's will. Submission. These are words of submission, are they not? It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. I remind you, the obvious, that this was not good news for Eli. This was not good news for his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. This was not good news for the future of his priesthood. This was very bad news. This was a news, I like the word in the text, where this is a word against Eli. This is a word of judgment. I will judge his family. So this was not something good for Eli. Many cases, as our lives change, as we bang into things, those unexpected shifts, they're not necessarily good. They're not necessarily easy. They do evoke questions and perhaps tears and perhaps resistance and objections, as I kind of teasingly indicated a few moments ago. But when push comes to shove, and we have poured out our heart to God with all of our sorrow and wonderings, bottom line, the Christian response to change is submission. It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. After all, the impression here is it is the Lord who's in charge. It is the Lord who knows. It is the Lord who has the bigger picture in mind. He can see far, far beyond anything I could ever see or understand or know. And even though I may not like it, I will bow my knee to him. That's not easy. I don't think it's automatic. But it is the goal toward which we should be moving. Submission to God's will. There's a little word that has come to mean an awful lot to me. I kind of like words. And it's a very familiar word. It is simply the word okay. Okay. It's okay. I call it okayness. We're supposed to be living with a spirit of okayness. Lord, I don't understand this. I would just as soon you not drag me kicking and screaming through this. I don't understand the whys and the wherefores, etc. But Lord, it's okay. It's okay. I brought with me a quote that I have saved over the years. It has helped me with this business of submission, and I share it with you. Be willing to accept whatever God appoints. Be pleased with all that He provides. Are you submissive to the divine will as to your place in society? Are you satisfied to be sickly, obscure, or of small ability? Are God's appointments your contentments? It is a happy thing when the mind is brought to submit to all the chastisements of God and to all the trials of His providence. It is a great thing to have the soul entirely submitted to God about everything, so that we never wish to have anything other than God would have it to be. We shall never be at rest until we come to this. It is essential to our happiness to say at all times, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. That quote concludes with the words of Christ Himself, does it not? And you see Him there in the Garden of Gethsemane on His knees, imploring His Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. And my mind struggles to grasp all that's going on there. But you hear Him express to the Father exactly what He is feeling. Let this cup pass from me. And then that expression is followed by submission. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And that's the pattern, my friends. That's the point this morning. When I talk to you about submission to the will of God, I'm not talking about just a sullen silence in which we just kind of grab a hold of ourselves, say nothing, grin and bear it, and go on. No. It is much more following the pattern of our Lord, in which we speak to God the Father and we talk to Him and we tell Him our sorrows and our questions and our wonderings and our whys. And then when we get all done pouring out all of that to God, we end up saying, it's okay. It's okay. You know better than I. Your will be done. That is the beginning of a Christian response to change. Submission to God's will. Now meet me at verse 10. We'll see the second in the Christian response. The continuing, perhaps I should say. The continuation of a Christian response to change. Verse 10, the other verse that I kind of flagged for you. Now the Lord came and stood and called, as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel answered, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. I put a label on that response. If the Christian response to change begins with submission to God's will, then it continues with sensitivity to His word. sensitivity to his word. Speak. I'm listening. I remember as a little kid in a dark tent growing up in Taylor, Michigan. I remember making those tents. They weren't the kind, you know, that were real nice and tailored. They were old blankets with clothespins on a clothesline. Some of you don't even know what a clothesline is. I am really dating myself. But you take those blankets and you put them up there and you clip them there. And now you take a big rock and you put it in the corner here and there. If your mother's not looking, you take a stake and you drive it through the corner. And now you have a tent. And you bring out the rugs and you put them in for a floor. And then you lay down and go to sleep, you think. And it's quiet. And you can hear a bird rustle. And you hear a twig snap, and you look out there, and there's the house, and it looks pretty safe and secure. Maybe I should go there. But as Samuel lay there, anticipating a visit by the God of the universe, Samuel, speak. I'm listening. You have my undivided attention. You do know that the biggest compliment you can give to anyone is to listen to them. Doesn't seem like much of a compliment, but actually it is. When you kind of clear your mind and your busyness and your schedule, and you're looking someone in the eye and you're listening intently to what they say and you're focused on them, that's a great compliment to them. We who are husbands have a little hard time with that. When our wives want to talk to us about whatever, and we don't even necessarily want to hear about it, and it's like, listen to me. Okay, you got my attention. That's a compliment. There's something about change. There's something about having the normal uprooted and shifted that does or should cause us to listen more intently to God. So I read his word with an edge, with a curiosity, with an openness that perhaps wouldn't otherwise normally be there. Or my prayers to him are much more realistic and much more intense. Or I listen to sermons like this and say, boy, what does the Lord have for me in this particular sermon or that Sunday school class? Our ears are open. Our attention is in place. That is a legitimate Christian response to change. It sounds something like this. Lord, I don't want to miss the lesson you have for me. I want to hear from you, and I just want to be tuned in and attuned to you so that I can learn and grow and respond appropriately. The Christian response to change in our lives begins with submission to God's will. It's okay. I'm not going to fight you. And it flows and continues to sensitivity to his word so that he has my undivided attention and I am focused and riveted on what he's saying to me. That's a Christian response to change. Years ago, when I pastored, 100 years ago, I and my family used to enjoy a TV show on a Friday night. Now, a lot of the members of our church didn't like that show, and so we didn't always broadcast that we were watching it, but it was kind of a comic relief for us, for kind of the heaviness of pastoral ministry. It was called The Dukes of Hazzard. I knew I was going to date myself when I said that, but you'll forgive me for that. And something you just dated yourself too, some of you. The Dukes of Hazzard. I remember some of those shows, you know, with Luke and Bo Duke and Uncle Jesse and Daisy and my favorite, Roscoe P. Coltrane. I always enjoyed him. And you know how that story went, where the Dukes would get themselves in trouble with the law, and usually it was the law's fault, of course. And then you have this chase scene. They destroyed more orange Dodges than I don't know how many. But somewhere in that chase scene, as they're flying around and trying to avoid getting caught and so on, you'd hear somebody say, "You got your ears on? You got your ears on? Are you listening? Are you tuned in?" And it seems to me that that's what God says to us as we work our way through changes that are pretty tough. And he shouts to us over the din, "You got your ears on? Are you listening to me? I have something I want to say to you. I have something I want to teach you in this. Tune in. Get your ears on. Be sensitive to my word in your life." I mentioned early on that I have been the representative of the churches for over 17 years, and that involves a lot of travel. We have 148 churches in our fellowship. This is one of them. And so we travel. We travel about 33,000 miles a year, all around Ohio and beyond. That's a lot of travel. Of course, the way Ohio is laid out, there's a lot of freeways, and I kind of like that. You can get anywhere pretty quickly, pretty easily. Except for construction. Those orange barrels, you know. Now, I particularly like cruise control. And I can set the car, you know, on a religious 73 and just go, you know. My wife and I travel a lot together, and she's usually reading. So we travel very quietly and just kind of moving along until those orange barrels start going, whew, 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 whew. And she'll kind of look up and she'll say, "I think you ought to slow down." Sometimes she says it a little more imperatively than that. "Slow down." But then secondly, she'll say, "Turn off the cruise." "I don't want to turn off the cruise. I'm trying to get through this thing as quickly as possible and get back to normal." That's what we do with change too. Let's just get through this thing as quickly as possible and get back to normal. There's one problem with that reasoning. Normal will never be the same again. You're heading for a new normal. And so the exhortation of this text is, slow down, take off the cruise, get your ears on to God. Listen for the message he has for you. Say it's okay and move on. The Christian response to change begins with submission to God's will and moves us to sensitivity to his word. Help us to respond Christianly, come what may. Father, thank you for these friends. Many of us have known one another for many years, and it's been a great joy for that relationship and that friendship, not only here but in other connections. I know that. Help us, Heavenly Father, to trust you, to realize and remind ourselves that you really do know what you're doing, And you really do care about us and our best interest. And in light of that, Father, help us to bend the knee and help us to open our ears to be faithful followers of Christ. I pray that in Jesus' name.